was an extraordinarily special day. It happened to be the 40th anniversary of the departure of Srila Prabhupada to the United States. That means yesterday, exactly 40 years ago to the day, he boarded the Jaladut and went across the shores, and then the rest is history. It is not a coincidence that His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada's appearance in this world has come a day after Janmashtami, which is next week, exactly a week from now. And also the day after Lord Balaram's appearance day. Lord Balaram, from whom the Guru Tattva comes, it is not a coincidence that Srila Prabhupada, his own appearance, his own birth was the day after Janmashtami, and the new birth that he gave to the world came the day after Balaramji's appearance day. So that is a message for all the world. So it would be very nice that we know something more about Srila Prabhupada. And even though we may feel that we know enough about him, that is the first sign that we really don't know anything about him. Because it is impossible to know the activities and the mind and the heart of a pure devotee. But we can take some guidance and learn some of the lessons. Srila Prabhupada's story may give us the impression that it was the last 12 years of his life, from 1965 to 1977, after he went to America, that there was a complete revolution, and the whole world could see his success and glory. So in a sense, that is true. But actually, his story, it's really a saga of how Lord Krishna and his pure devotee reciprocate with each other. How Krishna not only arranged every moment of Prabhupada's appearance, it was as if there was a drama being staged, and Krishna, with the help of all the parampara, had laid the stage before the curtains open. And we do get some glimpses, though every moment of it was actually directed by Krishna, but we do get some several glimpses of where Krishna directly intervened. This is very visible, and we will see those, how right from the time he was born, the visibility was in front of us. So one may say that before Prabhupada went to the United States, he had one disciple. For the first 65 years, he had only one disciple. For 69 years, he had one disciple. And then in the next 12 years, he had more than 4,000 disciples. He had written 3 books before he went to the United States. Then he wrote more than 60 volumes. Before he went, nobody could even dream that there would be a worldwide society of devotees. And then after he went to the United States, he established and nurtured ISKCON. Before, he had never been outside India before he went to the United States for the first time. And then after he went, in the next 12 years, he traveled the globe 14 times. So that is why people may get the impression that it was really suddenly, his sudden appearance to the West was the manifestation, and till that time it was either dormant or not really visible. But it's only like stage drama, that the curtains open only at the right time, but there is the whole preparation, and revelation comes at the appropriate time. In the words of one of the, when he went to the United States, one of his disciples later commented that it looked as if it was just like a genie popped out of the Aladdin's lamp. It suddenly came from nowhere. You can imagine the kind of social milieu that was there in the United States. And suddenly an old man comes there, and then what he transformed, it was like magic. So that is really to the superficial eye, but the depth was really Krishna's signals and messages. The first intervention we can see, where Krishna actually gave us the glimpse, is the family that he was born in. He was born in a family of pure Vaishnavas, very, very rare, even in those days. He was raised to be Krishna conscious. How many of us, how many people in this world could have parents like what Srila Prabhupada had? Especially his father. His father had three Vaishnav goals for his son. He wanted him to be a servant of Radha and Krishna. He wanted him to be a preacher of the Bhagavatam. And he wanted him to be an expert Mridanga player. Three main goals for his son. I don't know how many people in this hall may have a father who has these goals. In fact, they came from a very well-to-do family. The father, Godmohan, they had a cloth business. So the family members and his wife and others had aspirations that Prabhupada go to the West and become a barrister. And it was his father who objected and said, "No, I don't want the bad influence of the West to be on him. And that becomes a womanizer and starts drinking and so on." So this was the family in which he was born. Prabhupada later said that his first remembrances, when he was just a few years old, of his father was that father would come home in the night, close his shop, come late, and then when young Abhay Charan was just 2-3 years old, he was asleep, and then he would wake up because his father would come and worship the deities before the father would go to sleep every night. So then at the age of 5, he introduced him to the Rath Yatra. Abhay Charan had his own little Rath and his own team of he gathered, and he was the natural leader and took out the Rath for the whole neighborhood to participate in. At the age of 6, he got his own small deities. So in this way, it was a training which was really ordained by Lord Krishna. So the guidance was already there. And then, of course, the fateful day in 1922, when Abhay Charan was 26, and his friend Narendra Malik met him, took him to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur for the first time. Abhay Charan was reluctant because he had seen several sadhus. His father had invited many sadhus home. He felt it was one of them. Plus, he already had his ideals on liberation for the country. But when he met Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, his guru, on the very first meeting itself, Abhay Charan came back feeling that I want to surrender my life to this personality. He was very, very impressed. So this was another intervention at strategic moments, at very crucial times of his life. These are manifested to our eyes, while actually the whole play was every moment. But at times it's different. You can say at the act 1, then act 2, act 3, the curtains will open, we would be seeing the revelation. Then after the disappearance of his Guru Maharaj, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, Abhay Charan continued preaching. He had taken initiation already, and he was completely convinced. So along with his pharmaceutical business, which he was selling, he was also preaching heavily. And over time, the energy he put into his own business was becoming less, and his energy into preaching was much becoming more. Because that was his vision. He had got some messages and some orders from his Guru Maharaj, and that became his major driving force right through his life. He was meditating on it constantly, contemplating on this, on the orders that his Guru Maharaj had wanted. And we will see later how much the interaction with his Guru Maharaj was. So therefore, he made every effort and he never deviated from his vision. Here was a so-called ordinary person, no resources, just a 45-year-old simple businessman preaching at the side, and he had visions of having a worldwide society. He never for a moment felt that he should not try. And that was his goal from the time he met his spiritual master. And there are so many proofs. For instance, when he started the Back to Godhead magazine in 1944 single-handedly, he wrote the manuscript, he conceived the idea, he wrote the manuscript, he would type it himself, he would go and sell, and he would distribute free copies to so many people, including the prominent people. He sent just an ordinary man among the hundreds of millions of Indians, and he sends a magazine to Dr. Rajendra Prasad, the president of the country, the prime minister of the country, not seeing that being overawed by the position and designation of the people he sent to, but knowing that as a servant of Krishna, he needed to give them also guidance as to what they should be doing. So he never missed that. And then finally in 1947, he wrote to Mahatma Gandhi. This is an extraordinary event where here was again an ordinary person, and from a prominent personality like Mahatma Gandhi, who must be getting probably thousands of letters a day, just one letter coming in. This was dated 7th December 1947, 4 months after India got independence. And Abhay Charan writes to Gandhiji and tells him, he signs it as your unknown friend. And he says that I am, as a sincere friend, I am advising you, I am pleading with you that you should retire from active politics if you do not want to die an inglorious death. He praised him, that he said, what you have done so far, it is very wonderful, but now is the time, you spend 1 month with me and we will discuss Bhagavad Gita and so much you can do, and this is what you should be doing. He never got a reply, and as we know, on just 1.5 months later, on 30th January 1948, Mahatma Gandhi was shot dead. But Abhay Charan had his own goals. He continued, he persevered with his own efforts. He had no resources practically. And since he was now spending more time on preaching, he went to Allahabad, and there he took his family there initially. And then later on, his family was staying in an apartment in Calcutta. When he went, then he started the League of Devotees, a society in Jhansi. He got an abandoned temple there and he started his activities. And when he was in Jhansi, there was another intervention which is Krishna's intervention, which is apparent to us, that came to the world at least. Then he got a telegram once saying that his business in Allahabad had been burglarized. So servants had stolen everything, all the money, everything that he was there. He had nothing left. And what was Abhay Charan's reaction? He opens the telegram and he reads this. And to an ordinary person, it would be a moment of shock. Very few might even kind of come out of it. Some may go into depression. And here he immediately laughed. Because he was seeing everything from the eyes of his spiritual master and Lord Krishna, he was constantly seeing signals that were emanating from the other world. So he laughed and he immediately uttered a verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam, which said that Lord Krishna, he bestows a special mercy on those sincere devotees by taking away, whenever he sees the material success of those sincere devotees, he takes that away. And that was his instant reaction. And though he was advised that why don't you go back to Allahabad and make efforts, but no, he took this as a signal that now I should go further ahead. And he continued his efforts, even though in Jhansi he got a setback. Then he was, the governor's wife wanted to use that temple for some social purpose, so he had to vacate it. But he never left heart, and he had that strong feeling within him. And then the next intervention, which is seen to us by Krishna, came in the form of a dream to Abhay Charan. One night, this was in the early 50s, Abhay Charan is living a life of a mendicant. He has absolutely no possessions, stays in the different temples, wherever he gets an opportunity to stay. And there, one night he got a dream, and a tall, scholarly sannyasi is approaching him. And that was Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj's guru. And in his dream, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj is beckoning him that, come, you should now take sannyas. This is the way you will be able to preach to the world. And then shortly thereafter, Abhay Charan takes sannyas in 1959. In fact, he got dreams twice. Initially, he took advice. Others told him that, well, wait for some time. And so he was already in Vanprastha. And then in 1959, when he was 63 years old, he took sannyas. And all this time, when he was traveling or staying in temples, he was constantly occupied in preaching the Bhagavad Gita message, the writing the and distributing and publishing the Back to Godhead single-handedly. Whatever little money he would get, again he would publish it. Because that was the order of his spiritual master. If you have money, print books. But after he took sannyas, immediately after, he started writing the Srimad Bhagavatam, the translations. And the Srimad Bhagavatam, because he had his vision and he felt that now the preparation has to be stepped up. He had no money. The Srimad Bhagavatam was, he estimated that it would take probably 50, 60 volumes to cover those 18,000 verses. So he, again, every stage, somebody or the other, acts as Krishna's representative. So somebody recommended that, why don't you talk to Hanuman Das Podar, Hanuman Prasad Podar, a businessman in Gorakhpur, which was 500 miles away, who was known to support religious publications. So Abhay Charan, that time he was now Bhaktivedanta Swami, he had already taken sannyas. He goes to Gorakhpur, and Hanuman Prasad Podar gives him 4,000 rupees, a princely sum in that time, for printing the first volume of Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, first volume. And with that, then he was staying in nearby the printer, because he was continuing his efforts. So every day he had to walk up and down several miles. He was staying in a small temple in Chippiwada area of Old Delhi, and a completely nondescript place. But his whole time, walk several hours to the printer, do the proofreading, and help, and then come back, translate, and totally absorbed in his meditation. Actually, it was during this period, just some years ago, I personally had, there is a wonderful saint who stays in Gujarat. My family is knows him very well. He's about 93 years old. And he actually recollects vividly. In fact, he's a very big supporter of ISKCON. He has great feeling. He has a very large following himself. And he remembers that he was also in that time in that area. And that time sadhus used to be given one room. They had small rooms. And then every day they would be given prasad. It would be kept outside the door, and then they would take the prasad in whenever they wanted to. He said, I clearly remember that this person was unusual, because several days on end the prasad would just pile up. That means he wouldn't even open the door to take the prasad. So this, he saw it in the late 50s, and now, because we knew in the early 90s, but he sensed that this person. So there are many instances, people who interacted and had opportunity to see at any stage, to see his completely transparent love for Krishna. So then he was translating and continuing his efforts on his own. And then when he wrote, he got sponsorship for the volume 2. And then, in the meantime, he also, another intervention from Krishna, which revealed to us, was that he got an opportunity to stay in Radha Damodar temple. And when he was in the Radha Damodar temple, he saw this as Krishna's arrangement. Because he was already meditating that, I have to now get ready to implement, I'm already 68, 69. I have to implement my Guru Maharaj's orders. And he was waiting to complete the third volume. And here he was in Radha Damodar temple, which is one of the holiest of the holy places in the entire universe. And he's just a few feet away from Rupa Goswami's samadhi. And he was in ecstasy because he was always meditating on Rupa Goswami's orders and his own mission, what he had to do. Whenever he used to cook his own prasad, his own meals, and when he used to eat on a prasad, he was always meditating, looking at Rupa Goswami's samadhi, Jiva Goswami's samadhi, and thinking how, praying to them that give me the strength that I can fulfill your orders. But he was completely convinced that the Srimad Bhagavatam will revolutionize this misdirected civilization. That conviction he had so strong that he continued every day, seemingly no hope. Externally, there was nothing to say. Here, he was just living as a mendicant from one place to another. Now he's come to Vrindavan. But externally, there was no change. Somehow, somebody would give some sponsorship and he would get some volumes printed. Who would have even imagined? And yet, he just said, Krishna will reveal what he wants to do. And he was convinced that Krishna had sent him there to take the blessings of the six Goswamis. And he was also convinced that Rupa Goswami wanted him to go to the West. Bhakti Siddhanta Maharaj wanted to go to the West, wanted him to go to the West. That conviction he had. So then he completed the third volume, and while he was in those in late 64, 65, early 65, wherever he, in preparation for his completion of the work and his wanting to go abroad, wherever he got an opportunity, he would tell people, okay, I'm thinking of going to America, and if you can help me. So he was telling this casually to several people. One such person he met in Mathura was Mr. Agarwal. And he told, so this Mr. Agarwal took it seriously. And then many months later, suddenly, again, this would be one more intervention which is revealed to us, that suddenly a letter comes from the Ministry of External Affairs. We know how the government works. To get a letter from the government, and that too in the right time, itself is a miracle. So clearly here he gets a letter saying that there is a sponsor and your papers are in order. Now you just have to get your visa, passport, P form. So he was very surprised, and then he investigated and he found out that Mr. Agarwal, whom he had spoken to many months ago, had actually written to his son, and his son had written to the ministry saying that he is willing to sponsor. So this behind the scenes activity was hotting up, and then he got all his papers. That was easy. Then he comes to Bombay, and Bhaktivedanta Swami, then the most transcendental personality in the universe, comes to beg for one ticket. And then after a lot of persuasion, Sumati Morarji finally agrees, and she puts him on this cargo ship. But before he goes, he went to Mayapur for a day because he was wanting to take the blessings of all the great saints and the parampara. And there is a wonderful story which was revealed only now when a book came out by the pujari of the Advaita Acharya Bhavan in Shantipur. And it so happened that this pujari was in 1980, after Prabhupada had left this planet, he came to Mayapur. And he came and he had this Back to Godhead magazine with him. And he came and he talked to the devotees there, and he said, I have a story to tell you because you may want to know this. He said, I have been a pujari in Advaita Acharya Bhavan from 1940s onward. And right through the 40s and 50s, one Bengali grihastha would come regularly, at least once a month on weekends. And he would come and he would sit at the back of the mandir. And he would just chant, eyes closed, very intensely. For almost 10 years, he was seeing that practically every month he would come there. And often when he was chanting and intensely for hours, and often he would be crying, his tears would be rolling down his eyes. But he never spoke to the pujari, except when he finished, when he used to go, get up, and before going, he would thank the pujari, thank you for your seva. That's all. And then he would go. And then after there was a big gap. He never saw him for more than a decade. And then he clearly remembers, the pujari remembers that in August of 1965, a saffron-robed sannyasi was sitting at the back of the mandir. And instantly he recognized him, that this was the same person whom he was very attracted to, because he saw that this person had a lot of devotion. So after, and this time in August 1965, the sannyasi was sitting at the back, and this time he spent several hours just and he was weeping much more than what he was at the time of his earlier appearances there. And then after he finished, and he was observing him, this pujari, and then he finished, and then he paid his dandavats for a very long time. And then when he was going, he came to the pujari. So the pujari then asked him, he says, "Who are you? I have not seen you for a long time, but I had seen you 15, 20 years ago, and now I see you now." So then he said that, "I am Abhay Charanananda Bhaktivedanta Swami, an unworthy disciple of His Divine Grace Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and He has given me an impossible mission. And I'm trying to fulfill this mission." And while he was telling also, he was crying. And he said, "I have come to take the blessings of all. I want your blessings. Tomorrow I'm going to Calcutta to take the ship. I do not know what Krishna has in mind, but I'm waiting for the for his signals." And that was the last he saw him. And then in 1980, when this pujari saw in the Back to Godhead, he saw the photo of Prabhupada, and he was completely struck. He said, "My God, this personality was successful." So he came and then he told the story to the devotees there. So we get a glimpse of right through, even though we were seeing only some manifestations later on, then how much he was intense in his prayer for a project and for a mission which is far beyond what just a bunch of individuals or a group of us could even imagine. And then of course he went back, and then on 13th August 1965 he boarded the Jaladuta. All he had, his personal possessions, there was just an umbrella, one suitcase and a bag of cereals. Why? Because he didn't know whether what he will eat there. That time the travel was so less, he didn't know whether he would have anything to eat. So he said he will probably survive on cereals and boiled potatoes. That was the faith, and then he boarded. And of course, the only thing which gave him real confidence was that he had several trunks which were handled by Scindia steamship of 200 of his three set volumes which he was taking with him of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Then of course he went to the West, and we know the story of how much he was personally affected in health, and when he landed there. So Prabhupada in his humility would always say that, "I am simply a messenger. My only purpose as a postman is to deliver the message of my Guru Maharaj coming in disciplic succession, presented as it is to all of you." That is true, but actually he is the first person that Krishna chose to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world. And actually there have been several predictions and prophecies which were made at different times, which indicated that this was destined and was planned by a much superior authority. Prabhupada, of course, you know, even in 1974, when he published the Chaitanya Charitamrita, he, in the introduction, in the very first volume, I will read, he says, he is so consistent and clear in his thinking. He says, "Since we belong to the disciplic succession from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, this edition of the Chaitanya Charitamrita will contain nothing newly manufactured." I don't think anyone normally writes introductions like this. Normally you write something very big. He very bluntly says, "There's nothing newly manufactured by our tiny brains, but this only contains the remnants of foodstuffs originally eaten by the Lord Himself. And this is not the arrogant scholarship of a mental speculator, but it is the sincere effort to serve the order of a superior authority whose service is the life and soul of this humble effort." So this is of course his thinking right till the end. Because Prabhupada's entire being was completely filled with humility. He never ever saw himself as anything but just a servant of the servant of the servant. He lived that. Another example is that when he was in an advanced stage of, in his, just a few months before he went to Vrindavan for his final Leela in 77, he was already a man of 80, 81. And His Holiness Giriraj Maharaj clearly remembers that Prabhupada was praying in front of Radha Rasbihari. And he was praying intently and he was crying. So, afterwards, Prabhupada, Giriraj Maharaj, when he spoke to him, that Prabhupada, what happened? I mean, why are you crying? So Prabhupada told him that I'm just praying to Radha Rasbihari that I don't fall in Maya. So Srila Prabhupada, of course, was a Paramhans by, and especially at the age of 80, I don't think there was any question of being attacked by Maya. But nevertheless, that was his mood. So the predictions and the prophecies, which we should know philosophically how this was ordained, so that we can take this mission more seriously. There are several instances in the Bhagavatam, in the 10th canto, the personified Vedas, they are praying to the Lord and they are requesting the Lord that the Lord, please be merciful and deliver your message to the living entities who are in Maya. And your highest manifestation and is your compassion. So please, out of your compassion, deliver them. Because this misdirected civilization needs an empowered soul. So Srila Prabhupada was the chosen empowered soul to actually deliver it around the world. Nobody has done it all over the world. Also in the Bhagavatam, in the first canto, 5th chapter, 11th verse, it says that all those literatures which are full of descriptions of the name, fame, pastimes of the Lord, these will create a revolution in the impious lives of the world's misdirected civilization. And such transcendental literatures, even though imperfectly composed, if they are heard, sung and accepted by purified men who are thoroughly honest, they will change and revolutionize. This is actually the in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Now here we can see two issues. One, when you talk of a world revolution created by the Srimad Bhagavatam, where else has it happened? This Krishna consciousness movement, which Srila Prabhupada established through ISKCON, was the first when Srimad Bhagavatam in the language of English was made and presented to all over the world and changed, is changing the world. And second, it also says that even though if it is imperfectly composed, and those who have read the first volumes of Srila Prabhupada, of the Bhagavatam, know that there were many technical imperfections, but they were, because they were presented in a highly spiritual and honest way, they have been accepted and purified by, it has purified men. Also in the Chaitanya Bhagavat, Lord Chaitanya himself says that in every town and village my name will be sung. And this is also envisioned by Bhaktivinoda Thakur when he said later that someday I pray that all the Russians and the Americans and the British and the Africans and the Swedish, all of them come together in Mayapur to chant the holy name of the Lord. Who else has done this? It is clearly Srila Prabhupada's glory. Also, Bhaktivinoda Thakur directly predicted that a great Acharya will come to create a worldwide movement, a Sankirtan movement. Then there were other signals that in the year of Srila Prabhupada's birth in 1896, Bhaktivinoda Thakur's book was for the first time established or accepted by the library in McGill University in Canada. And then, of course, most important, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, his own Guru Maharaj's various prophecies, which were made before his departure before 1935, about Prabhupada going there. The first we know was when Prabhupada met him as Abhay Charan in 1922, when he told him that you are an educated young man, go to the West. Then in Bombay, where the Gaudiya Mutt had the center in August Kranti Mark, very 5 minutes from here, many of the devotees and Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj were actually sitting there, and they were discussing. No, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj was not there, but many of his disciples were requesting Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj. That time Abhay Charan was staying outside. He was a very strong preacher, and he was already a kind of leader among them, and they all very much appreciated that. So they were asking Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj to tell him to stay in the temple, join and come and help us. So Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj wrote and said, just let him be. When the time comes, Abhay will do everything. Abhay Charan will do everything. So let him pass. So that means Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj knew that there is some matter of time it will come through. And then two disciples of Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj. The first one is Bhakti Kamal Madhusudan Maharaj, direct disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj and a godbrother of Srila Prabhupada. He related a story, which he is no more now, but he related a story before his departure. And he said that this again happened in the August Kranti Maidan, Bombay, Gaudiya Math, where this time Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj was also present. Many of the senior disciples were there, including Sridhar Maharaj, and some of the top disciples were there. They were discussing, strategizing how the preaching in the West should start and take place. And that time, Bhakti Kamal Madhusudan Maharaj, the one who tells the story, at that time his name was Narottamananda Prabhu. He was a brahmachari of 27 years old. And because he was preaching in English, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj pointed to him and said that, you are a preacher in English. You have my blessings. You can go to London. You can go there. So Bhakti Kamal Madhusudan Maharaj pleaded and told Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj Prabhupada that I don't want to go. He was crying. He said, I will not be able to bear separation from you, and I need your association, and I don't think I please don't push me into going there. So Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj was very kind. He said, okay, don't worry. But then somebody asked him that, but what will we do about this London preaching? So that time again, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj said, when the time comes, Abhay will go. So I can see that he will go there. This was related by Bhakti Kamal Madhusudan Maharaj himself. And another disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, Nayanananda Das Babaji Maharaj, again a godbrother of Srila Prabhupada, who also is no more now, but he related this wonderful and very mysterious story before he went, and which is in the captured in the book, that this was the last of the Gaur Mandal Parikramas that Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj had organized, and it was the last day, and they were in the Champahatti Mandir. And at that time already some devotees, disciples of Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, had gone to the London, the first attempt, and that afternoon only the disciples had come back, and they were not fully successful. And in the evening, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj was addressing the entire gathering. There were thousands and thousands of pilgrims. And in the first few rows, there were the brahmacharis and sannyasis, and then others were several thousands of pilgrims were there. So that time, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj was telling him his dream and his vision, because this was fresh in his mind. And he said that that Bhaktivinoda Thakur had a vision, and why it is so important that this message should go all over the world. And his own mother, that is Bhaktivinoda Thakur's wife and Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj's mother, Bhagwati Devi, her last wish before she left this world and addressed to Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj was that you should go to the, that this should happen. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's message should go all over the world. So Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj was relating this to this entire gathering there. And at that time, at that moment, he paused and then he looked left from where he was sitting. And on the left, there's Nayananda Das Babaji Maharaj was also in the line of his vision. So first he thought that Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj is looking at him. And then he saw that he was staring intently at someone. So he turned back and he said, because he saw that he was not looking at him. And then he saw that the person with whom he was making eye contact was Abhay Charan. And then he just saw, he said, I will never forget it, that both of them had such a deep look. Thousands of people are just waiting patiently, and here Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj is looking. The two of them are exchanging some transcendental signals, and he was looking very intently at him. And then Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj turned, and then he addressed the crowd. And then he again said, but I will make a prediction. One of my disciples, no matter when it will happen in the future, one of my disciples will go to the West and will bring back the whole world. These are the exact words he spoke. And this was spoken in the mid-30s. So, this is in, that means Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj was completely convinced that Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada will fulfill his mission. He had that confidence. So, it was like a relay race of coming through the parampara, passing the baton, and then somebody ends the, but it is really effort of the whole team. So, Prabhupada's personality is very difficult to define. You cannot, you know, he was, it defied any cultural designation. Because he was, his identity was purely spiritual. Though he was, you can't call him just a Bengali, or just that he was only an Indian, because he was not adhering strictly to the normal Varnashram norms. For instance, although, of course, he was a Vaishnava Brahmin because he was a scholar and he wrote so many books, but at the same time, he did not hesitate in going into day-to-day management whenever it was necessary, because he had to establish the mission, and that was necessary even though he wanted to be relieved of that burden and concentrate on his translation, but when it was necessary, he did it. Also, he was a sannyasi. He accepted the women who came to him as his daughters, and he engaged them in Krishna's service. Although he was an Indian, he always preached in English, even to those people who were speaking in Hindi, because he saw this as a world movement. He was, whether it was to the communist or to the capitalist, he was always telling them the same message, that the Supreme Personality of Godhead controlled this world, Lord Krishna controlled this world, and everything has to be offered back to him. So, he encompassed everything. He was not fitting into any normal cultural designation. At the same time, like any bona fide acharya, he had his own stamp on ISKCON. It is said by Rupa Goswami that actually when every bona fide acharya, they have their own particular stamp, and those differences are called details. So they are not on philosophy, but they are on taking the time, place and circumstance into account. And several of them of ISKCON, we can see, bear the stamp of Srila Prabhupada. For instance, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj's disciples would chant 64 rounds, and Prabhupada himself was chanting 64 rounds then. But then he brought it down to 16 rounds, because he saw that these Western devotees, for instance, at one time he was in a room with his disciples in the early days, and he asked, after he had already initiated several, and he had told them that they have to chant 16 rounds, and then he asked, he used to regularly check, so when he asked them that, is there anyone who is not chanting 16 rounds? So Nandarani Mataji just put up her hand, she's saying, no. And Prabhupada said, why? Saying, because my temple authority said that I am doing these services, and that is more important. So then Prabhupada, of course, corrected and told that, no, chanting has to be done. The services have to be adjusted, but you cannot miss this. But the point is that this was the situation which he was in, so he had to adapt and make it a worldwide movement. Also, his introduction of the Rath Yatra, which was unique. Of course, it is said in the Nectar Devotion that the festive Vaishnav should organize and glorify the Supreme Personality, and Lord Jagannath is most merciful. But Prabhupada took that because he was, as we know, when he was 5 years old, he was organizing Rath Yatra, so he was already heavily influenced by his own childhood, and he knew that this would be something which would be very attractive to the Westerners. You know, the parade and the feast and all that. So it was like fitting into their own cultural feeling, and the Westerners just took to it. So it was a brilliant stroke of a genius of combining the spiritual potency of Lord Jagannath and adapting it to the Western technology and culture. Then publishing and distributing of books, the emphasis that Prabhupada put on it, that was his heart and soul. Because his Guru Maharaj had told him that if you have money, print books. And also he knew that in this material education society, people are going to come only when they're convinced. So when they read, they're going to come to forward. Also, when he allowed women to stay within the temple confines, that was really revolutionary. That had his personal stamp. He saw that they wouldn't have grihastha couples joining the temple. Then of course, he brought in some wonderful innovations, intelligent innovations to adapt to the Western mind by introducing the Sunday love feast, and which otherwise we would not be sitting here, which was really one of Prabhupada's products. And prasadam distribution, which again they brought in wonderful organization, talent, and did it in every corner, and it's happening even today. Then having a large Vyasasan, and the importance of having daily Guru Puja. Till that time, the Guru Puja was only once a month, I think, once a month or so, or once a week. But Prabhupada emphasized that this is not just adoration, but it is a Divya Gyan that is being given, and how important the position of the Guru is. And of course, how he married the East and the West. That was among his unique contributions, where he took the spiritual potency of the East and he took the Western money and technology and managerial talents, and especially when he built the three big temples, Vrindavan, Mayapur and Bombay, were the perfect products of the Western money and Eastern spiritual influence. So this had his own stamp, and through that he brought all his disciples together, and the love that they had for him was so intense and strong that they were willing to do anything for him. Of course, along with it, he had his own humor, which all along, but something which really embellished the relationship, and which was such that it was never hurting to anyone, but at the same time, it just brought everyone closer to him. One instance when the teachings of Lord Chaitanya, the book was being, it was ready, and they were deciding on the cover. So, since this was again just a few years after he started the movement, so Prabhupada was emphasizing at that time that everyone should have short hair or no hair, because he said only hippies have long hair. So that was the first time when disciples, devotees saw on the cover of teachings of Lord Chaitanya that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had long hair. So they said to Prabhupada, Swamiji, you said that he should have, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was having long hair. So Prabhupada said, yes, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was a hippie. So then he said, he was a hippie because he's come to save you. So everyone was laughing. But then Prabhupada realized that because of his Bengali accent, the devotees were not sure whether he said save or shave. So Prabhupada immediately picked up. So he said, yes, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has come to save you and shave you. So like that, he really endeared everyone to him so much that today when his disciples recollect the early days, what really made them come so close to him, and almost 30 years after his departure, they're willing to carry this mission on their own and sacrifice everything. They recall that they had this one conviction that he was our well-wisher. It took them months sometimes to understand his Bengali accent, but this feeling of heart-to-heart connection that he was a well-wisher and he meant well really were sunk very deeply in their hearts. Now, of course, Prabhupada's main mission was to really translate his books and various books and distribute them, because he knew that he had limited time. So particularly the translations and the purports were of tremendous significance. I mean, there we should understand how much we would benefit just by understanding how much effort he put into it. That he would rise early, he would get up at 1 in the morning and would translate for several hours. He called them the conversations with the whole world. And for us, for disciples, grand disciples, these purports are actually an intimate spiritual communion with Prabhupada, through which we can actually see Krishna. The kind of effort that he put into it, he put maximum priority on this subject of, and initially he typed the first two cantos, first two volumes of the first canto himself on his old portable typewriter. You can imagine how many months and years he must have taken for that. And then later on he was using a dictaphone and taping it into a tape and then sending it, mailing it to his disciples who were then typing it out. There are many statements by Prabhupada which established the importance he gave to his books. For instance, he said that my books will be the law books for the next 10,000 years. He was making a statement of fact. It was not a matter of personal pride. As we've seen, that he was a totally surrendered soul. But he saw that this, and he always said that I'm not writing this, Krishna was writing it. And he would take pleasure in actually hearing the message of Krishna by his own translated works. Also, he said that these purports are my devotional ecstasies. Oftentimes he would say that there is nothing new that I have to say. Everything you want to know, you find it in my books. He also said writing is the first duty of a sannyasi. And then to all the preachers, he would say that my books are like gold. It doesn't matter what you say to the two people. Those who know the value of gold will purchase them. And these purports, we should know that Prabhupada took them. He had a Bengali translation of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And then he had commentaries from as many as 12 great acharyas. Apart from Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, Bhakti Vinod Thakur, Sanatan Goswami, Madhvacharya, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Jeev Goswami, Sridhar Swami, Veer Raghav Goswami, others. So he would take all these and ultimately give a deep thought to it. And we should not, in fact, his disciples were at one time wondering how fast he was going compared to the task that he had in hand. So they were kind of complimenting him that, Prabhupada, you are going really quite fast. But he said that actually I could go much faster, but I have to really think very carefully and concentrate so that you can understand that. So we should know that these purports, they actually give an access to the thoughts and the devotion of the entire disciplic succession. And this the time that he was taking was basically indicating to us that it is not just a static translation. It was not just that he was taking the commentaries and then just translating them only. But actually, he was struggling to apply the all the wisdom of this parampara and the commentaries and adapt it to the modern-day mentality of these Western people. And that was a real challenge. You can imagine, for instance, how he would have to give the message of presenting the principles of Vedic government. Here these were people who were completely ignorant of anything, and he has to put it to them in a way which they can understand. Or the position of women in Vedic society. Or even the fact that they should abstain from sinful life. Imagine, he was telling this to people who were addicted to sinful life, and who didn't even know, who had no idea what was wrong with it. For instance, Her Grace Yamuna Mataji, one of the leading disciples of Prabhupada today, she's told us that when she first met Prabhupada in 1967, she had actually come there to attend the wedding of her sister, Janki. And she was the only representative at the time for the marriage. So she flew all the way from Oregon to New York. So Janki and Mukunda were the first marriage that Prabhupada performed. In fact, that was one of the things which also Prabhupada's stamp, that he himself performed marriages, which was quite rare. But then, that, as he said, it was an emergency. So when her name, Yamuna Mataji's name was Joan that time. So the first time she went Prabhupada, so Prabhupada said that, so who else is coming for the marriage? So she said that, no, I am the only person, Swamiji, representing Janki. So Prabhupada was saying, acha, in India, we have marriage means a lot of family members are there. He said, never mind, you and I will represent the bride. So that was the kind of warmth he used to feel. And then when he was teaching, he and Joan were actually preparing the prasad, the feast. She didn't have any understanding of what Swamiji represented, that there was something like Krishna and there was an etiquette, nothing. So in the middle of the cooking, she asked that, Swamiji, can I just smoke? So now Prabhupada never, got angry. He said, no, you can just wash your hands and come. But then, these were the instances which Prabhupada took and understood their mentality and then gradually brought them from, picked them up from the ground and made them into supreme Vaishnavas. Malti Mataji also related once that when she and her husband Shyam Sundar were actually making, Shyam Sundar was, Prabhu was an excellent carpenter, he knew carpentry, and he was making the Jagannath Baldev Subhadra deities, which were the first Rath Yatra deities. They were making it in their apartment, and suddenly Prabhupada one day paid a surprise visit that to know how fast the quickly the progress is being made. And when he came there, he saw a packet of cigarettes on Lord Balram's head. So imagine such a transcendentalist, and but his instant reaction was saying, "Oh, what is that?" So they were very embarrassed. They're saying, "Prabhupada, this is cigarettes." So Prabhupada only said, "He said, 'Acha, you have difficulty in giving it up.'" He said, "Okay, smoke one cigarette less every day." And then he said something very, very profound. He told Shyam Sundar Prabhu, he said, "Why do you let such a small stick stand between you and Krishna?" Instead of reacting angrily, which he would have been justified in doing, that how what a blasphemy to have, he never saw it that way. He said in such a way that Shyam Sundar Prabhu immediately gave up smoking from that day. This is the way he really dealt, and he brought these people with love to the highest principles of spiritual life. So his translations and his commentaries, his purports, carried on right till the end. To the very last days of his life, when he went to Vrindavan, he had actually stopped eating and drinking for several months. At least he stopped eating for several months, and he was only having liquids. Even he had become so weak, even then he continued this translations. Even when he had no strength to even hold the microphone, Jayadvait Swami and others would hold the microphone very close to his mouth, and he would continue giving the purports, the translations, and the strong messages. But Prabhupada always said that, "I would like to die on the battlefield. I will not retire from the..." Because he saw this as a battle against Maya. And on behalf of the parampara, he was giving Krishna to this entire world, which was degraded in a degraded society. So he knew it was an uphill task. But therefore he said, "Whatever, I am a nobody, but I will give this to the last strength that I have." So he gave every indication and his personal example to his disciples. Because Prabhupada had the vision and the determination and the blessings of the parampara to carry this on. And in his last stages, in his Antalila, he gave two major basic messages, which of course were there right through his entire life and with his interaction for the 12 years with his devotees, but it was in a concentrated form in the last months. First was how a pure devotee departs from this world, and the second was how he captures them by his love and brings them closer. So especially in the last few months, he really brought these two very much to the highest levels. First, about his, of course, he was teaching right through that we are not this body, we are the soul, and that death can come at any time. This is padam padam vad vipadam. There's danger at every step. So we should be always prepared. Nevertheless, when the time came, he gave himself as an example of how one should depart. And not only was he constantly chanting, surrounding himself with kirtan, he had all his disciples and his godbrothers and some of the most greatest personalities of Vrindavan were coming to meet him. his concentration, his motivation, his thinking was his entire thinking was always around Krishna or how he could spread the message of Krishna. And devotees saw the comparison with Bhishma Dev's departure from in Kurukshetra. There were so many similarities. The two of them, Prabhupada and Bhishma Dev, both were generals in the war. There, the Kurukshetra war, and here was the war against Maya. Also, the two of them, they controlled the departure. Bhishma Dev went at the time he wanted. Prabhupada went at the time he wanted. Also, Krishna came to their bedsides. In Bhishma Dev's case, Krishna actually wanted Bhishma to speak the science of governance to Yudhishthir Maharaj. And here, through the holy name, which was the mission of Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada's entire mission was to spread the holy name to every nook and corner. And that's what he spent his entire 80 years. And at the final stages, he surrounded himself with kirtan, and he was still propagating the holy name. So Krishna came through his holy name. And last but not the least, both of them were surrounded by so much opulence, success, women, but they were completely detached from all that. So many devotees saw that this is, that they reminded his departure with Bhishma Dev's departure. And as far as love is concerned, the reciprocation of love, just like Krishna, through his Krishna Kalia pastime, really brought the intense love of his disciples, of his followers, to him in the greatest intensity. Similarly, Prabhupada also would give the position of dependence often, as if he was completely dependent on his own disciples several times. And he showed them so many different types of loving relationships. He, through his own interactions with his disciples, he taught them how we should love our spiritual master. Through his own example of loving exchanges with Krishna, which he made visible to his disciples, he taught the disciples how to love Krishna. He also taught them how to appreciate Krishna's love for us. He also taught the disciples how to appreciate the love that other great eternal associates had for Krishna. And also he taught that love is not mechanical, it's not official, but it is something real and something very tangible and something very heartfelt, the spiritual emotion. And to the last day, he was encouraging them. There's a wonderful example of this where just few days before he left this planet, he suddenly asked that he wanted to be taken for a Govardhan Parikrama in an ox cart. Now, Prabhupada was a bundle of bones by that time. It was so painful for just resting on the bed. Every few hours he had to be turned so that his body would not ache. And here, he had not eaten for months, he was only on liquids, and he's saying that he wants to go on the ox cart. And just this request completely divided his followers into two camps. I mean, they were all having intense love for him. One set of devotees were saying that this is Prabhupada's last wish, our Guru Maharaj's last wish. He knows best, we must do what he says. How can we say no? And the others were saying that this will kill him, which was a fact. He would not survive this 22 kilometers on an ox cart, which would be so bumpy, and when he couldn't even rest on the bed. And Prabhupada was just witnessing this. He was just watching his disciples interact. And then finally, when he decided that he will not go, then he revealed himself when Tamalkrishna Maharaj said, "Prabhupada, sometimes your actions, just make us so dependent on you and bring the maximum intensity of our love for you. We can't understand this." So Prabhupada's reply was, "That is my duty." So of course everybody laughed, and they were with full understanding. So the point is that Prabhupada's only goal was to capture the spirit souls and bring them to Krishna somehow. So preachers tell us regularly that God has love for us. But actually, it needs a true lover of God to bring that confidence in us that this is true. Srila Prabhupada brought the residents of Vrindavan from the books of mythology right into our hearts and into putting them as the ideal examples of the best lovers of Krishna. And he also wrote the Krishna book so that we could see how Mother Yashoda and Lord Brahma, the gopis, actually what intensity of love they had for Krishna. So ultimately he taught us that bhakti is everything, that is the highest devotional service. So while we understand that, there is also a danger for us, for grand disciples and great grand disciples and many others will come, that we should know what is sentimentalism, because Prabhupada was very much against that. Because if we just pay lip service to Prabhupada's glories but do not follow him, then it is sentimentalism. We just shed a few tears and see his great example, hear about it, it's nice to hear, it's very dramatic, very powerful, very moving, but then we are where we are. Then it is useless. It's just sentimentalism. Prabhupada wanted solid work. He never wanted this sentimentalism. There are many examples of that. For instance, once when he was going from New York to Boston, he had a late preaching program, and the next morning he was taking the flight to Boston early morning. So the temple president unfortunately could not get up in time, and Prabhupada left. So after reaching Boston, Prabhupada wrote back to him and he said that don't keep praising me, do as I do. So he gently admonished him that it is your duty, you have to take this up more seriously. Another time he was, some lady disciples had started a temple center in Jaipur and they wanted him to come. But they made no arrangements. So Prabhupada did not go. He wanted that we have to work for it, we have to make an effort and really win the approval of our spiritual master. To satisfy our spiritual master, we have to work hard. It is not something which we just put up our hands and say, Jai Prabhupada, Jai this, done. That is not, we never wanted that. Once he arrived in Albuquerque, which is a small center in New Mexico in the US, and he was invited there. But after he landed there Govinda Dasi, who had called Prabhupada, she met Prabhupada at the airport and she was in tears. She said, Prabhupada, I'm sorry, we have no money, so please go back. So Prabhupada was quite upset. He said, I've just come. I can't immediately take the next flight and go. At least you make arrangements for at least one day, and then I will go tomorrow. So she was saying that she started crying. She got so flustered. Naturally, this Prabhupada is upset and she didn't want that. So she's saying that, Prabhupada, you know Krishna and Krishna knows you. So please ask Krishna what he wants to do. So Prabhupada got very angry. He said, that is not the point. Krishna wants to know what you want to do. So he never accepted it. He wanted that. He had so much loving sentiments. But at the same time, that has to be translated into service in of various kinds. Starting with seriousness in our chanting and our associating with devotees, but at the same time, wherever we could take the opportunity, we should go forward. So that is one message for the grand disciples and all of us. Also, Prabhupada would warn all his disciples, that we should not take things very cheaply. We should not become complacent. Because the nature of the soul is that, when things are going well, we put our legs up. And Prabhupada would always say that either you're swimming upstream or you're swimming downstream. When a strong current is there, many of you may have experienced in the floods recently in Bombay, the currents were so strong that, it is not something that you could just relax and float on the water. You're either going upstream or downstream. So at that time, you have to struggle. Either you're struggling for the right cause or struggling materially also. So therefore, we should be constantly struggling for the right cause and not give up. Even if it is 10 years, 20 years, that doesn't matter. We are still neophytes. Also, Prabhupada, he lives in our hearts. Because many disciples may feel, many grand disciples, that, if only I was there when Prabhupada was there. But if we have that mentality, thinking that, I really missed the boat, Prabhupada was not there. Of course, it would have been, those who directly interacted with Prabhupada,
they were supremely fortunate. But that same fortune is available to us through His instructions. His instructions are actually what Prabhupada said, the Vani is available and will be available for the next 10,000 years. So we should carry this on further. Otherwise, if we are not able to associate with the Vani, then even at the time when Prabhupada would have been there, we may have committed some offenses. We would not have accepted, because millions of people had darshan of Prabhupada. Thousands spoke to him, but only a few thousand actually became serious. So who knows, we would have not been. So when the time has come now, we have been given the right opportunity, the right time. We have the chance to reciprocate for all that has been done to us by giving back. And also, this movement is a Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya is a very glorious movement, because also it is, we have the Diksha Guru, which is most important, and we have the Shiksha Guru. And the Shiksha Guru in our Sampradaya, in several cases, several acharyas, they have been having, had great influences by the Shiksha Gurus. So Prabhupada will always remain in our hearts as our Shiksha Guru. So we have every opportunity to directly interact with him. He will be guiding us through in our hearts. But we should see that we do not minimize the position of our initiating spiritual masters. That is most important. We have to do it in disciplic succession. But the point is that we have a personal connection also with Srila Prabhupada. And in this way, we could actually try to bring this, our life, into some sort of sanity from the kind of lives that we may have been leading all these past years. So I'll stop here, and if there are any questions or any comments. So, Jai Satchinandan Prabhu will have Kirtan. So, one way to reciprocate with Srila Prabhupada is, of course, participating in the Kirtans. That's another thing which we had nobody would have had any inkling what a Kirtan is, what Sankirtan is. Actually, everything that we know practically is come from our connection with this movement. And if we really reflect on that, we would see how much we have been given this blessing for apparently causeless, that's a causeless mercy. Srila Prabhupada ki